Okay, so we're all here because dwarf galaxies are basically a pain in the butt, as you all know. And I think you all know very well this diagram. So this is, let's just look at this top panel for a second. This is the mass of stars divided by the mass of the host dark matter halo at redshift zero as a function of halo mass. And so we all know that dwarf galaxies have to have a very small fraction of the baryons that you could imagine being available to them that have turned into stars. So this blue line here is showing constraints from abundance matching, where you just ask how many stars can you put in halos and still match the observed stellar mass function. Now, in order to match, in order to make this happen physically in cosmological models for galaxy formation, there's sort of a standard approach that many people these days use, and that is to adopt very strong and efficient supernova feedback, supernova-driven and massive star-driven winds. And the usual way to implement that is to assume that you have outflows where the outflow rate is some mass loading factor times the star formation rate. And this mass loading factor, in order to match this slope of the F star relationship, is often assumed to be proportional to the circular velocity of the galaxy to some power. Can you guys see this? I don't need to put the lights on. Yeah, okay. You'll know this anyway. This power is typically of order 1 to 2 or even larger. On this plot, so the black line is from a semi-analytic model where I've assumed a value of 2 for that alpha. You can see it's still a little bit too steep. If I made that 2.2, then you can get it to lie right on top of that line. So obviously that means that the amount of mass that's being ejected from the galaxy in low mass galaxies is actually much larger than the amount of mass that's turning into stars. Now the other thing that I would argue we want to match at redshift zero for galaxies in any model is the fraction of cold gas in the galaxy. So that's what's shown here. The points here are direct measurements of gas. The squares, I think, are from Kanapan et al., and the dots are from the Things sample and from Baldry et al. And you can see that low-mass galaxies are very gas-rich, as we heard about, talked about last week. So the way to that, again, most people have accomplished this in models, typically people assume some sort of Kennicott law, right? So star formation rate is proportional to the total cold gas fraction to some power, as long as the gas, let me change notation here, the gas surface density is above some critical value. And there's, you know, various variations of what one assumes for this critical value. Again, in this plot, I've assumed that this is just a constant, 6 solar masses per square parsec, which is in reasonably good agreement with observations. And so then what's going to happen is in your low mass galaxies, they have a lot of gas. They're relatively low surface density, so they have a lot of gas that sits below this threshold, so it can't make stars. So you end up with high gas fractions. So that's all good. So in principle, now we can tune our model to fit the stellar mass function or luminosity function down to as low a mass as you want, as low a mass as it's been observed, and the gas fractions also. But then, if we look at the star formation rates, so this is specific star formation rate versus stellar mass, redshift zero, same model. The star formation rates, or specific star formation rates, are going to be too low in the low mass galaxies. And that's because we've assumed that there's, the dots here are data from Karim et al. The lines are from Sloan, from Salim et al. And this is just showing the star forming sequence and then the Green Valley and the red sequence. What we're interested in here is just the blue line, which is the star forming sequence. So the point here is that if you cannot reproduce all three of these sets of observations simultaneously in any model that I know of that's based in Lambda CDM. So that's sort of problem number one. Problem number two, now we come back and look at the other panels on these plots. So now I'm plotting this F star quantity at redshift 1, 2, and 3. So the shaded blue regions are where we have observational constraints. Of course, observed stellar mass functions don't go down to very low stellar masses at high redshift. These are going down to about 10 to the 9, 10 to the 9.5 or so at redshift 1. And then the dotted blue line is just extrapolating, assuming that the slope of the stellar mass function stays the same. So what you can see is that the black lines here, again, are the predictions of this same model, these different redshifts. And you can see that this F-star relationship doesn't evolve, basically doesn't evolve. Galaxies just move along that relationship. And that's because of this very strong self-regulated supernova feedback. So basically, you know, the potential well that the galaxy is sitting in tells it how much mass it can have. And there's no physics in here, right, that tells it that that should change with redshift. Whereas the observations are actually telling us that at a given halo mass, you're forming a smaller budget of your baryons into stars at higher redshift.
Yes. What if instead of finding the condition of the surface density, then it doesn't have density, so there would also
3D density?
Yeah.
Doesn't help.
Because the results may change, right?
Of course, the results may change. So, you know, you might think, oh, this, you know, A, this is a semi-analytic model, it's just bogus. B, maybe it's surface density versus volume density. So when people...
You said there's nothing that scales with redshift, but the surface density of a typical galaxy will be higher and higher redshift because...
So that goes the wrong direction.
But there is a scaling of redshift, right? And then the potential wells are deeper, the escape velocities are higher, so
everything
there are some natural scaling.
But everything goes the wrong direction.
Okay.
Right? Both of those things go the wrong direction. They tell you that star formation should be more efficient at higher redshift. You should form more stars at higher redshift in a given halo mass. So yeah, I agree. There are some scalings with redshift. It turns out they're not very strong. And actually, if you run a cosmological hydrodynamic simulation, like, for example, Ramil Davay and Ben Oppenheimer and collaborators have implemented very similar recipes for winds in their hydro simulations, and they get basically identical results. And they implement a 3D density threshold. So I agree. It might have made a difference. Those are very low resolution simulations. Maybe if you did, you know, a proper simulation where you were capturing more physics.
Capture the higher density beams.
Yeah. So, you know, here this is all very low res stuff, and maybe when we go to higher res, more physical simulations, these problems will go away. I don't know. That's why we're all here. Okay, so that's problem 2A, okay, that the F-star relationship predicted by the models doesn't evolve the way the observations seem to indicate. And then linked problem, so now looking at gas fractions at high redshift, unfortunately we have very few direct measurements of gas and emission at high redshift, of course. So the colored lines are showing indirect gas fraction measurements that come from inverting the Kennicott-Schmidt law at high redshift. So this is, you know, I don't believe this very much. You're completely free not to believe this at all. These are the only sort of direct gas measurements that I have on here, which are from CO at redshift 2. Other problems there with conversion factors. But if you take these measurements seriously, you can see that the gas fraction relationship also doesn't evolve very much in the models, where we might expect that galaxies would have been more gas-rich in the past. And, you know, this is sort of the same thing that we're seeing here. So now this is star formation rates. And you can see that the models underpredict the star formation rates, especially in low-mass galaxies, as you go out to high redshift. So, of course, you would infer that there would be not enough gas there. Now, there are a couple of other problems that I'm not going to show you the plots for because of my five-plot limit, which I'm going to violate anyway. I hope you don't notice. But this is written up in a paper by Fontenot. At all 2009, so you can go look there. But so the other problems that are related so we had F star, I showed you specific star formation rates, I showed you here the observations are, I think, sketchier and more difficult to interpret. But there's some indication that low-mass galaxies are enriched too early, which sort of goes along with they're forming their stars too early, they're consuming their gas too early. And
is that enriched too early in reality?
In the models. In the models. So here, in models. Okay, so another way of putting that is that, taken at face value, the observations indicate that low-mass galaxies' metallicities evolved a lot. And the models show, again, very little evolution in the mass-metallicity relationship at low masses. And then, this is sort of going to sketchier and sketchier, the models also have difficulty producing enough damped Lyman alpha systems, so enough gas sitting around to make damped systems, and they don't do a good job of producing the kinematics. So we tend to produce too many systems with low delta V. Again, this is getting more and more uncertain, so I don't know how seriously to take it. Okay, so
to come back to this, here there must be some arbitrary scaling that you can adjust with the IMF, right?
Aha. You mean to change the normalization of the observations? Sure. Yeah, of course.
But largely that problem can make go away by just the minor change.
If you want to change the slope, then you have to change the IMS as a function of galaxy properties.
I don't want to change the slope. I mean.
Well, the
data there.
The bigger problem is the slope.
But
I would argue.
The data is uncertain, right? There are as many papers.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, that the slope is flat, and then
At low redshift, I think I agree. People argue about it, but at low redshift, I think. They're with errors. They're hard to see, but there are actually error bars on here. That doesn't include the scatter, right? That's just the error on the mean. So with each of these, there are errors on the observations. There are systematic biases and uncertainties that we can talk about. That's part of why I'm showing all of these different quantities, because they all have different errors and biases. And so the fact that we're sort of getting the same picture from these different sets of observations is part of what makes me think you can't just tweak it away by tweaking the observations. Oh, and I actually forgot one of the things on my list here, which is that stellar ages, so if you estimate stellar ages from galactic archaeology, that the ages of dwarf galaxies in the models are much too old, right? So age, mass, the models predict a very gentle slope here, and the observations show a much stronger trend between age and mass. So again, that's pointing to the direction of, in the models, the dwarf galaxies are forming their stars too early, and then they're too quiescent at late times. I'll also make one more comment that we heard from Marla last week, that if she continued this diagram down to 10 to the 7, she found all galaxies were what she called unquenched. And she said that's sort of like being above minus 11 here. Turns out that if I make that plot, and I have that plot somewhere if anyone wants to see it, and extend it down, the results are consistent with that. So the star formation rates are too low. They're not quenched, but they're just too low. But they're still above this sort of quenched line. So that's kind of interesting. Okay, so this is the problem. As I've mentioned, this problem exists in, it's been demonstrated in at least 4 or 5 different semi-analytic models from different groups and in hydro simulations. So it seems to be something, it's not a detail in the modeling. So
can I just ask you sort of very general question?
Yeah.
Coming from the observational side. You talk about some systems and biases. I mean, when you're doing these simulations, are most of these dwarf-like galaxies, what observers would call field galaxies or satellite galaxies, and are the comparison samples that you're comparing them to biased in any way towards, isolated objects in the field that stand out? So I'm just wondering, because obviously the environment is going to be very important.
Thank you for asking that. That's a great question.
I'm curious.
Yep.
Where are the simulations approaching this from, and how does this relate to the observations you're comparing it to?
Yep. Thank you for asking that. I should have said that what's plotted here for the models are only central galaxies. So you would consider those to be sort of field galaxies. If I plot satellite galaxies on here, they actually fill in this part of the plot. And all of these problems are even worse for satellite galaxies in these models. So I'm actually cheating by showing you the best galaxies, because for satellite galaxies, we can always make excuses that they got stripped or we don't understand what's happening to them. So these are really for central galaxies. And, you know, for these samples, these are dominated by field galaxies in the observations. I think we can be fairly sure. You know, there might be a 10% contribution from satellite galaxies. Okay, so one thought that various people have had, including Michael and his collaborators and Andre, is that if we implemented a more realistic treatment of star formation in these kinds of models, that might help solve this problem. So in particular, the idea is that, of course, stars form in molecular hydrogen. Formation of molecular hydrogen depends on the metallicity of the gas. And so you might expect that low-mass galaxies at early times had lower metallicities. And so the star formation would be less efficient. And maybe this would give us a differential effect in the direction that we want. So I've implemented the recipe from Nick and Andre, and also from Krumholtz and collaborators in these semi-analytic models. And I just want to make a few comments about how we do this. Of course, one has to do this in a simplified way. So we have an estimate of the disk size in our semi-analytic models from basically angular momentum conservation models plus adiabatic contraction, so the sort of Momau and White standard approach for doing this. You may or may not believe this, and I know Allison's shown that this doesn't work in detail if you, you know, follow what's really happening in simulations, but okay, we get the mass, stellar mass, disk mass relationship right. It agrees with observations up to redshift 2 as far as we can measure it. So empirically, this is giving us galaxies with more or less the right sizes in the models. And then we assume that the disks have exponential profiles in both the gas and the stars. So that gives us a surface density distribution for our gas. We do chemical evolution, so we track metals as they're produced by stars. Then you have to assume something about where the metals are dumped. Are they dumped straight in the cold gas? Are they ejected?
You don't say how you can set up an exponential disk in the gas, but then your star formation recipe tells you what, how many stars you form as a function of radius.
Right, so I'm not doing that.
Is that or not?
I'm not doing that. I am just assuming global averages for all of the galaxies. There are models, so Fu and Kaufman, you probably know their work, have done the same thing where they track things in annuli, and it actually works worse when you do that, probably because, you know, there are secular flows that move gas around within the disk. So if you try to really resolve that, you have to add that physics to your model, and your model becomes much more complicated. So we're staying simple here. So we have exponential disks. So then we have a formula for the fraction of molecular hydrogen as a function of the total surface density of the gas and the metallicity of the gas, which we take from Nick and Andre's recipe or KMT or whatever. And then the star formation recipe now is proportional to the molecular fraction times some molecular, I'm not writing this properly, so this now becomes base, I'm not going to write it out, but so now our star formation is based on molecular gas. So you can take any empirical recipe you like, such as Bégiol et al., which says star formation is proportional to molecular gas density to some power close to 1 with some efficiency. So we have the usual free parameters in our model that set the star formation efficiency and the slope of this now molecular Kennicott-Schmidt relation. Okay. And everything else I've left the same for purposes of illustration, all the feedback and so forth. So these little panels here, I realize this is cheating by putting a billion panels on one plot, but it's actually kind of nice, I think, to see them side by side. So this is a halo with a final mass of 2 times 10 to the 9. The mass resolution here is 10 to the 6 in halo mass. This is what you can do with a SAM, right? And this shows the stellar mass, the cold gas mass, the total cold gas mass, star formation rate, and the metallicity of the cold gas.
Sorry, what is the zero of time?
I'm sorry?
What is the zero, the origin of time?
Yeah, zero is here. Redshift zero is here.
Yeah, but where do you start your, like, you're starting from which point of the, during the formation of the halo?
They start whenever, so I make a merger tree down to some mass. In this case, it's 10 to the 6.
Right.
So they start whenever I first predict that there should be a 10 to the 6 solar mass halo. So I have an ensemble of 10 to the 6 solar mass halos that form whenever they want to form, and then I follow it down, right? So that's why... Yeah, in principle, you would go back to the Big Bang, but in practice, it's set by the mass resolution.
But in the real world,
the
bottom
from
what?
Does that make sense? Sorry?
You start from redshift 20, your merger tree starts at...
They go up to redshift 20. I mean, there's no... I think the hard limit that I put on it is 30.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I said, the halos sort of form when they want to form, and the lower the mass resolution, the further back you're going to go.
There's no reionization physics going in, right?
There is. Okay, I didn't mention that. That's actually also very important. So there is photoionization squelching using Andre's recipe, and here I assumed, what's that?
The Gnadenhadal one?
The Gnadenhadal one.
He was here. Remember what he said?
Does he disown it now? Okay, I'll show you in a minute what that does. It doesn't change any of the conclusions. But I'll show you in a minute what that does. So this may be a slightly too extreme photoion. The filtering mass may be a little too high here. I think that's okay. But that's also included in here. So the purple is the old Kennicott recipe, and the green is the new recipe. So you can see that for this tiny halo, and you can see this tiny halo forms a galaxy with, in the standard recipe, 2 times 10 to the 6 solar masses of stars at redshift 0. And with the new recipe, it's more like 10 to the 6. So this is a very tiny little guy. And this recipe does change the shape of the star formation history in the way that we want, right? So it takes it from being something that's declining to something that's rising.
Are your outflows metal enhanced, or have the average metallicity of the ISM?
Here they have the average metallicity of the ISM. That's a very important part of the modeling that we're playing with right now. But here they're just tracking the mean metallicity of the ISM.
What happens in the upper right?
Up here?
Far right.
The far right? Okay, so this is a bigger halo. This guy's 10 to the 10.
Yeah.
And same deal. So basically, what you can see is that the stellar mass is not changed very much with the new star formation recipe, but the gas mass is. So the galaxies end up being much more gas rich because they have a lot of H1 sitting around that can't turn into stars. And here, even at 10 to the 10, the star formation history is almost unchanged, and the stellar mass is almost unchanged. So what you're mainly doing is delaying the enrichment and making the galaxies more gas rich.
I don't understand what I'm telling you, because in your standard Kennicott recipe, you still have a certain surface density, basically 6 solar mass,
and that's constant.
At which, above, relatively small metallicity, you start turning cold gas into molecular ions.
Yeah.
So I don't understand why, in the end, you end up with much more cold gas, because if you have about the same amount of stars, the metallicity is huge, so basically you're effectively using exactly the same sigma crit as before.
Why do you say that sigma crit is 6 at one
point? That's what she's...
No, it's not.
That's what you adopted in your standard Kennicott recipe.
In the standard recipe, it's 6, but isn't it much higher at low metallicity?
Yeah.
So that's exactly what you're seeing here, right? You can think of it as just an increasing threshold.
It doesn't saturate at some point? It should saturate at some point, but we don't have any data. Essentially, it depends on how fast the gas ratio scales with metallicity, and we don't have any data at 0.1, so it must break at some point.
Yeah.
Usually, we just assume that also that the stuff gases bring reach to some 10 minus 2, 10 minus 3, or
And that's the same thing I did here. So it's the gas starts out at 10 to the minus 3 initially.
You assume that scaling works on cold,
right? You have to start with some seed metallicity. Yeah. So did that answer your question, Crystal? Okay, so here's 10 to the 10. You can see already not much is really happening here. And by 10 to the 11, the results differ very little between the new recipe and the old recipe. And again, that's pretty easy to understand because even with this delayed enrichment, the galaxies are still getting enriched to high enough metallicity that the star formation efficiency isn't very different at a fairly early time.
Sorry, maybe I missed it. In your lowest mass halo there, mm-hmm. the star formation rate with the Z-dependent star formation recipe,
uh-huh.
it doesn't form anything until, am I reading that part right?
Until redshift 7, 6.5-ish, yeah.
So there's zero old stars.
Well.
In that form.
I mean.
Is that right?
Yeah, there are very few stars older than 6 gigayears. That's true.
Okay, I'm not aware of any galaxy.
That's probably very sensitive to the photoionization recipe. So we should.
That's because you're not aware of it, because this galaxy is 10 to the 6 of the masses and stars, and we know very few galaxies.
Yeah.
Yeah, but true. I mean, everything sort of on that mass that you basically look at is in the very nearby grid.
That's right.
And there's everything had. Yeah,
no, it's an interesting point.
They all have at least some old population.
Yeah.
Albeit very old metal.
Yeah.
Usually a very old population.
And this is sort of the same point we talked about with Michael's talk, that, you know, if you now these are probably not the galaxies that are doing reionization, but since you're delaying the star formation in low mass halos, it might be difficult to reionize the universe with galaxies in these models.
The other thing I remember from Nick's talk when he gave to the conference organizer something like some months ago,
yeah.
was that the problem with this recipe was that you don't quite reproduce the metallicity luminosity relation.
That's the problem with Nick's models.
Right.
I've made the same plot, so I have H2 following that model, and I do not get the same trend. Right. I need to get a mass metal relationship.
That's what I'm saying. So this is Nick's model, right? It's
okay.
That's it. But so does mine. No? Mine also follows that. I'll follow Smith's model, and I don't get to get a step function is what you're talking about.
Right.
At the conference, he had some like floor metallicity, and then there was like a jump in all his other galaxies.
Basically, you don't follow metallicity.
Yeah, she's saying she didn't really have it.
Yeah, I don't have that problem. It's the same thing again.
Yeah, and we certainly don't have that problem in the semi-analytic model.
Because the problem is not, problem of the model. It's a generic problem that you're trying to form something very low mass in high mass halo because the mass of the halo here is 10 to the 9
mm-hmm.
and you're forming something like 10 to the 5 solar masses in such halo, 10 to the 6. Now the amount of gas available in this halo is more than 10 to the 8 or whatever it is,
yeah.
2 to 3 times 10 to the 8.
Yeah.
And if you then take a typical yield from the total 10 to the 6 of stars and spread it over the available gas.
If you spread?
Yeah, you get very low metallicity, much lower than what's observed in the galaxies. So somehow these galaxies with tiny stellar masses, if they see that these halos are able to concentrate their metals where stars are not spreading around the whole better potentially will. And so it doesn't happen in our simulations, for example.
Well, but do we know, because the galaxies of this mass that we can see, like you were just saying, are in the local group. And they're not gas rich, right? They're.
So I mean,
I guess we don't know, but.
And so I mean, firstly, I mean, so Marlow is, you know, saying you need to go out like for very low radii or something before
right.
you get out to, you know, isolated field. In which case, none of the local group by that definition
right.
Is field. If you take sort of what observers might say as satellites within like 300 kiloparsecs, let's say, Milky Way or 31, then there's a bunch of things which are sort of 1 megaparsec out, things like Aquarius and Sagittarius, who are the regular galaxy, which are all kind of 10 to the 6-ish in solar masses.
Yeah.
And they all have a bit of gas, but not a very high gas fraction. So maybe
right.
the same amount of stuff in H1s as you see in stars. And then those sort of the star formation histories they're known well enough that, you know, we know that they have an old population and
right.
we know that ongoing low level star formation. But beyond that, we really don't know too many details about them. But there are such things, but again, whether or not that they're really comparable to this given.
Right, if they've been affected by their.
Galaxy with that, like SBS 335, the ones we created that they show just a very young population to get gas, so they may be at least not galaxy.
Yeah, I mean, there are other things like further away, that's true, but so, again, I don't know what. I mean, I'm not sure.
What is the stellar mass of the ones we get?
I'm not sure what the number is on 1 to 18, but I'm thinking like at a couple megaparsecs, you've got a GC1569, and you've got 1 3x28 solar masses of gas.
And metallicity is. I mean, I've made the mass metallicity plot compared with the Things sample, which they have like two galaxies that are a few times 10 to the 7 in stellar mass, according to their estimates. And I don't have any trouble matching down to that mass. So, you know, again, it's just hard to go lower in the field. But again, I think it's really important because it may have to do with how the metals are being distributed and mixed in the gas, which I think is going to be really crucial for what these recipes actually do.
I think it's going back to this metal enriched outflow. I mean, Juliana showed that the effective yield really suggests that metal enriched outflow is very important for setting these.
Yeah, I agree. So we've been playing with that. And so, you know, then you have to assume something for where up to what mass the metals can get out. So we used Andrea's old paper with Mordecai, and we said, okay, it can get out up to maybe 10 to the 11 in halo mass. And so basically you can delay things a little bit more. You can push things over a little bit more with that. But unless you think that metals are really escaping in halos bigger than that, then you can't solve the problems that I'm talking about today. I mean, it may still be interesting for other things. But, you know, it's a little hard to believe that a lot of metals are getting out of bigger halos than that. Maybe Crystal disagrees with that. I don't know. So, okay, so let me, yep. Yep.
So, okay, this type of feedback basically delays the formation of small mass halos. Mm-hmm. And it's a chemical type of feedback in a sense.
The star formation recipe, yeah.
Yes. So, I mean, but a similar effect, I mean, you could solve, I guess, from this plot that I see, this problem if you just have a stronger feedback that is mass dependent.
Well, the feedback is halo mass dependent,
no,
like, right?
I know that is the chemical. It's based on modifying the star formation pressure.
So tuning off at the 5 instead of 2.
But if you use any other type of feedback, photoionization, mechanical from supernova, or I don't know, that is much more effective in small mass halos than.
Sure.
Wouldn't you get pretty much the same effect?
All right, so if you want, I will skip. No, this is good. This is great. So, I know. Well, but he asked. He asked. These are reserve slides. I have 6 slides that I'm happy to stop after that. But if you want to know the answer to your question. All right. So you can just throw away all the physics, and you can ask, what do you have to do to the SAM to make it work? Right? So it turns out that you have to. You might think that, but then they should work better than they do. So we have to make the fraction of gas available for star formation. You can think of this like H2 if you want to. A function, so we made this an arbitrary function of halo mass and redshift. Okay, and the function is shown here. So at redshift 4, it has to look like this, and then it has to decrease, and then it has to come back up again. It's very weird. It's non-monotonic. So if we parameterize this as a power law, the power does this.
Is that similar to the where so the mapping between the circular velocity and the halo mass is also non-monotonic right there.
I don't think it's non-monotonic, right? Isn't it? Doesn't it increase? Doesn't the halo circular velocity
there's
for
some,
given mass?
There's some mass redshift range where it turns over. I can't remember exactly where.
Yeah, it might be below redshift 1 that it turns over.
Is your m orthogonal to vc to the n? That's m power.
What's that?
Is this your m orthogonal to vc to the n?
No. This is the fraction of gas in the galaxy that's allowed to form stars. So everything else is the same.
The fraction of gas that has cooled, or this is the fraction.
The fraction of cold gas in the galaxy.
This already has.
So this already has a cooling law in it, And this is, you know, so the cooling law is the standard atomic cooling law with metals, etc.
So what is the sound again? Because it's
so this is a power law.
It doesn't look as a power law. That's what
I think it's
scares us.
Yeah, I would have to look up the actual function, but I mean,
what's the Dapsone?
I don't know. My student sent me this plot yesterday, so I'm not quite sure. Ignore that line.
The reaction floor is the highest, so okay, maybe it's the slope, or
I think it's the slope. I think it's basically a slope. Yeah. So I agree. You have to make it a very strong function of halo mass, and it has to be a weird non-monotonic function of redshift. And I don't know any physics that can do this. So if anyone can think of any, Frank just suggested. Okay. All right.
Are you taking into account secular mass loss?
You mean not just mass loss from stars?
Not instantaneous, but the one that's delayed by...
No, I just have instantaneous recycling.
So that's the mass loss would do something like this, because if you have star formation early and you accumulate stellar mass, then later on, billions, years in advance, moving forward, these stars will be providing some steady stream.
Yeah, I understand. So we do actually have models where we include that, and we also include type 1As and so forth. It doesn't solve the problem. I agree with you. It goes the right direction.
Which problem does it solve? I'm just telling you that it could be one of the physics that can give you non-monotonic behavior, because that source of mass doesn't work at high redshifts.
Well, it's basically like a gas accretion. It's sort of a new supply of gas, right, that comes in later. Yeah. So
yeah,
I don't think with the standard IMF I don't think it's enough.
What about gas that's been injected into the circumgalactic medium that
falls back
that reaccretes later on?
Again, at least the way it's treated here, or the way it's treated in Ramil Dave's models, that doesn't, it's not enough. Now, that could be wrong, but.
Do you have effects of things like secondary inflow of gas from the HF?
What do you mean by secondary inflow?
So as the concentration of, basically, the gas is able to condense more in the potential world of the metal halo. That will depend on the concentration of the gas and the temperature of the HGN. So the amount of gas supply of the gas that was in insulation would have to increase, may increase actually less than one.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean still. I mean, this is a very simple cooling model, right? It's the standard semi-analytic cooling model where everything is spherical, and you know, we have hot mode and cold mode, but you know, if it's cold mode, then it's just the infall rate of the gas. So the cooling model is very simple. And again, you know, I wouldn't be so concerned about all of this if it weren't for the fact that people doing hydro seem to be getting more or less the same answer. So I don't think it's because the cooling model is wrong. Yeah. And we've also compared our cooling model with the hydro, and more or less works in terms of the trends. So, yeah. All right, so just to kind of wrap up that thought, here's my Baruzzi plot for the new star formation recipe. And you can see that it doesn't really solve the F-star problem.
Whoa.
Okay, so this is fraction of, this is F-star, right? Different redshifts. I realize the plot format changed because I made this plot. So now, the green is redshift 0, F star, from Master et al., which is the same as Baruzzi. And the blue is what you need to have at redshift 1 or 2 or 3 to fit the stellar mass function. So you basically, you want the models to be on the blue, right? And instead they're up here. So basically it still doesn't evolve with the metallicity dependent star formation recipe. Purple is the new model. Blue is the Baruzzi points. So basically the blue is just showing you only down to here do we really have observational constraints. This is all, well, at redshift 2 it does, but at redshift 1, no. I mean, you know, you can choose to not be bothered by that. When you look at the actual stellar mass function, I think it looks worse because it gets stretched out, right? All right, so just to zoom in, this is redshift 1, and so the purple here is just the old model without any photoionization squelching. So you can see that this cutoff here is coming from that filtering mass. So if you decrease the filtering mass, then things would move this way. So purple's the old model with squelching, new model with squelching. So you can see that it does help. It does bring the stellar masses down, but at halo masses that are way below where we can actually observe anything at redshift 1.
Sorry, the data are only the new, right?
Okay, so these are the direct constraints from the observations. This is extrapolating, assuming that the slope doesn't change. Okay, and there's actually now new observations from Wide Field Camera 3 that go down about an order of magnitude fainter than when this work was done. So I don't have the new points yet, but now we can go down.
So truly the problem is essentially 11.
That's right, exactly. 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11 halo mass is where the problem is. And that, I think that's why it's such a hard problem, because it's hard to think of physical mechanisms that do a lot of damage at those scales, right? And also, we know the metallicities of those galaxies are not very different from...
Is there any way to scale down the first model down to the top one? Because it seems that the slope is right and everything is okay, just the normalization which is a little bit high.
You can scale everything up and down by tuning the supernova feedback, but you don't change the redshift dependence. That's the problem, right? So I can scale it down, but then I won't get it right at a different redshift. That's always the problem.
So you need the...
Unless you...
The redshift dependent feedback.
That's the other thing...
Redshift dependent,
maybe.
But why you don't expect the redshift dependent? Why is that not allowed?
It's allowed.
Isn't this plot just a consequence of star formation? So the halo mass evolution, you care less about what stars are doing. This is set.
Yep.
Halo mass function just evolves the way it wants to evolve.
Yep.
And what happens to stellar mass in a particular halo mass just becomes an average star formation history between those halos. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so doesn't this mean that every tomorrow is just you don't get the star formation histories, right?
That's absolutely right.
So
that's absolutely right.
Why talk about in this language rather than in language of star formation history? There are constraints on star formation histories and the function of stellar mass.
Yep.
For galaxies. So
yep.
Why don't you compare it to that?
We are comparing with that, and I just didn't manage to make the plot. I can probably make the plot by, you know, before the end of the week. This is the direct. This is sort of the more direct comparison with observations. I completely agree with you that that's the right way to look at it. Because if you solve the star formation history problem, you solve all of these observational problems that I've showed you, this list that I had. So I totally agree with you. It's just that, you know, this is sort of an easier comparison to do. Because you have to put assumptions in order to get the star formation histories out from the abundance matching, right?
I think I agree with that.
I think if you get the matching between stellar mass and halo mass range to zero correctly,
yeah,
and you model star formation history of function stellar mass correctly, you have to have the evolution curve, right?
I agree. And I think it comes back down to...
Not necessarily. I think if you get in at zero, you can get from the top or below. You don't know.
No, but if you get the star formation history correctly, there's no more freedom after that. So the halo mass evolution is not part of that, right? You just have to get, for a unit stellar mass, iteration zero, you have to get star formation history correct.
Yep, but you also have, you know, you're getting those star formation histories from physical processes in this model, or a parameterized process. Right, so that's what we're trying to understand, is what kind of process do you have to put in to get the star formation histories to come out right. But I agree with you that the problem is that the star formation histories are always flat or falling in these mass halos. You want them to look more like this, but you need them to look like this up to higher masses.
So just naively, why are they not exponential? You would expect it to get a simplest.
Yeah, because you do have reinfall of gas that's been expelled.
So info is
maybe
over estimate. In that case, if you don't have info, you would have a nice.
Well, no, you want more info, right?
You want to decrease your star formation rate, right? So
no, no, no. I want to increase them. I want to increase them. I want them to go up.
But I think you want to keep the normalization ratio zero, roughly correct.
No.
No, if you look at a specific star formation, this thing is, it's an IMF thing.
All right, I mean, you can pick your solution. You can tweak some of the observations.
I think it's not this absolute normalization is taken. We can argue about it. That's maybe a problem. But the way I look at it, if you look at a specific star formation, the normalization of that black line as function of redshift.
Yeah.
The data shows that it goes up to about a redshift 2-3, and then it flattens. It becomes flat afterwards, as far as you can measure.
That is the hard part.
I think that's where the problem comes from. The models always get wrong.
Those are the extra stars that are forming in the progenitors of these halos.
Right. You can't solve that maybe. Because we see that problem existing at 10 to 10 solar masses.
At redshift 6 or something.
At redshift 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah.
So clearly, if you just do things with the metallicity that only affects things at 10 to 9 to 10, it's not going to work.
I agree.
So I completely agree with Andre that it is a specific star formation. I think that's the problem.
I agree completely.
I would therefore praise your. You need to do something at higher redshift rather than trying to keep things at lower redshift cool.
Here's the problem, though. If you kill off the stars in those halos at high redshift, then you don't get enough massive galaxies at redshift 3, 4.
You don't kill off everything.
You
kill off progenitors of today's forming galaxies. And progenitors of today's red galaxies are clearly more forming stars back then, right? So you don't want to kill off those guys.
So what does your luminosity function look like at higher redshift? Do you see the sort of steepening or faintening of the luminosity function people are now finding via models of LISA?
At high redshift?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think I have the right plot here, but I can look for it. We do reproduce it at low redshift, so we do get that little steepening at very faint faint luminosities at low redshift.
But at high redshift, it seems to be entire faintening flow is very steep.
You mean at redshift 6?
Yes.
Yeah, we match that. I mean, it's very.
You match that.
Yeah, but it's very easy to get steep steep functions, right? But so, I mean, that's why I think there's tension here. So if you start killing those off, you have to kill off exactly the right ones without killing off too many, et cetera. So, it's easy to sort of throw out these ideas, but in practice, there's a fair number of constraints now. All right, so, I mean, I've shown more slides than my allotment here. So I'm happy to stop or... What is my conclusion? My feeling?
What did it mean from? Depends on the day of the week.
I guess my best hope at this point is that maybe if the star formation histories of these low-mass galaxies are really stochastic, the way Allison was showing, that maybe somehow that would help. So instead of lowering the star formation rates in everybody so that you don't overproduce the number of stars, now you just have, only every 10th guy gets to be on at any given time. But then I don't understand why you never see anybody down here. But then maybe this is a selection effect, so I don't know. I guess that's probably the next thing I want to try to look into. I guess my gut feeling is that the supernova wind treatment that's put into all these models is just too crude and maybe just fundamentally flawed. So I think that's a place we need to. Yeah. I mean, when I started this work, I thought it was probably the star formation recipe that was causing this problem. And now I no longer think so. Because it turns out, we played around with like 1,000 different star formation recipes. And it just, the F-star relationship, whenever you have strong feedback, it almost doesn't care about what you put in for the star formation timescale, because it's self-regulated. So it has to be, I think it has to be something to do with the feedback.
Is that anything like mean equator or something like that?
person. Potentially never maybe there's a black hole, never be able to have a server.
How's that going to solve the problem?
I don't know. It's different feedback or extra feedback.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, so the other solution that might work is if you could prevent the gas from falling in the first place. So something like the photoionization mechanism, yeah, but it would have to be an incredibly high temperature, right? But if you could maybe heat with mini quasars, and then Massimo and I talked about this years ago. So you have to heat to, 10 to the 11, it's hot. To try to prevent gas from falling into those things. I mean, they aren't 10 to the 11 at high redshift, but still.
But at low redshift, 40% of the gas has a temperature that's higher than the third temperature within 3 minutes. So.
40% of the gas in the halo?
In the RGM. Warm-hearted like me. I mean, there is a phase transition in redshift 2, and suddenly you start producing a warm-hearted like me. 40%. Of the variance today are in the warm hearted neglected medium. That's it. It's never taken into account in any sense with Vermont.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. It's not fact. But just, given that they're all filaments and pancakes, redshift 2 basically get heated up to the temperature of 10 to 6K.
But that gas seems to still accrete.
And there's right? also the argument that the warm hearted neglected medium isn't actually intergalactic.
The argument against the gas, well, not again, it's happening. But why it doesn't affect things is because it also affects the matter.
Exactly. So you stop accreting gas onto that matter, so you follow, also get hot.
If you follow your mass accretion history, so that effect is already taken into account in mass accretion history in some ways.
So that's why you need a preheating mechanism that is decoupled from dark matter.
And that's why if you look at bottom fraction, they always stay flat with very low scatter. The gas is affected by this, also dark matter is affected. So I agree with you that it's some sort of cycle of feedback and stuff information raising, but I think you need to get both of them right to get it, to get the evolution. But can you comment, if you can, so there is a recent paper by Mark Kronholz and Alicia Dekel that did claim that all these fields that plug the galaxy evolution modeling are solved by stuff information raising.
Well, first of all, they have a very simple model that doesn't follow merger trees. It just follows a very simple mass accretion.
Right, but you think that their model, they get things wrong because of what exactly?
They aren't fitting a stellar mass function. And if you look at their supernova feedback, they're basically not assuming, I've erased it, but they're not assuming any VC dependence. It's just some constant times the star formation rate. So that's probably part of it. They also haven't really compared with observations. I mean, their comparison with observations is very sketchy. So yeah, they claim to solve all the problems, but if you look at their paper, they certainly haven't shown that they've solved all the problems.
We implemented the Kronholz's model in the models with Aaron Dutton.
Yeah.
And basically, again, when you start looking above 10 to the 10 solar mass, it makes no difference. And as I say, if you believe these specific star formation rate observations at higher redshift, then there things already go wrong. You need to come up with a mechanism that can suppress star formation in these relatively massive systems already. And that metal dependence doesn't do that. And
this is
basically coming to the same conclusion. Yep. You need to do something at a more mass event.
Yep.
So you would say that they would get the stellar mass function wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think they would also get the mass metallicity relation wrong. I mean, I think they would get many things wrong.
So can I just also comment? So this has been very interesting discussion, but another set of observations which I'm more familiar with. Huh. Is instead of looking at the function of redshift, just looking at all the galaxies within 5, 10 megaparsecs, or whatever like that. So Julian Del Canton's HST Anger Probe project. Dan Weiss has written a very nice paper deriving star formation histories based on actually seeing stars.
Right.
And there is, again, so it comes back to my earlier point, there's no galaxy that we've observed, be it a satellite, be it a field, in this general mass range that does not have an old population by old meaning. Older than 8 to 10 given years, it depends on their age resolutions.
But their masses are what? And stellar mass?
And it's basically everything within X megaparsecs, where X is something like 4 or 5.
Right, but so they can go down pretty far.
So yes, so, I mean, they basically have good age resolution back to age of 10 gigahertz, depending upon the precise galaxy. So it's just this,
like, you know, this
having to sort of stop things forming stars.
Yeah, yeah.
You might have to stop them forming most of the stars, right? But anything that switches star formation up entirely at
right.
many times
right.
seems to me to be, give you something that's going to be wrong.
So, yep. so do you think, yeah. I completely agree, and I think it's a very important problem. I think one way out would be to have this sort of episode of star formation pre-granization,
yep.
make fossils, and then that all that old star formation stuff is fossilized.
Would that be enough?
And, would it, have people looked into that? Can that work?
No, I mean, so you need to obviously have star formation pre-realization, and then one of the problems is that, you know, a few years ago now was, it's then very hard for things to start forming stars again, because, you know, even in the Milky Way satellites still have star formation between 10 gigahertz and that. So there is still low-level star formation going on in these things across the entirety of our economy.
Right.
So, you know, that you can switch something off, but then allow it to, you know, start up again in various periods, and I think that would probably work out exactly how that is.
Regarding that, that was what I'm trying to get to, and I didn't quite understand that. Secondary important thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a kind of a back of the envelope model.
Oh, you mean gas that had been heated and then it falls in as background drops. Is that what you meant?
It's that, but it's mostly the increasing the concentration of isolated dark matter.
I see. So that gas can now fall in, which couldn't before.
It's not that it falls in more. The mass is, you know, is the same, super velocity is the same, but it gets more concentrated for a given temperature of intergalactic medium. So it
okay.
can actually get
okay. Okay.
to reach higher density in the center.
No, I understand.
So if you play with that model, what you get is even small galaxies that get whose star formation get killed by ionization. A reaction less than 2 or so, they can start accreting gas from the interactive medium again.
Why is it getting more concentrated?
Because the concentration scales the reaction for the gas with the ionization.
Yeah, but that doesn't change potential,
was
it? Potential is the same.
Yeah, that's just changing the outer part of the halo.
Yes, it does, but if you do the calculation, you know, a better model for clusters, right? The core density in a cluster, using a bad model, depends on the concentration. The density of the gas in hydrostatic equilibrium for a given temperature.
Well, the density in clusters does not change. The concentration goes as 1 plus z, the potential and everything inside stays constant.
I know, but if you do the calculation on an NFW with different concentration parameters, and using a beta model, you find that the gas has a core
that is. When concentration evolves as 1 plus z, the only thing that changes is the linear radius, because mean density of the universe evolves, nothing else changes. Exactly.
So you're right, it is dependent on concentration, but for an individual system,
the center shouldn't
the center
change.
Potential doesn't have to get
the core radius.
Yeah.
No, I understand, but the reason why you get a more concentrated density profile is that in hydrostatic equilibrium, now you have a turnaround region is much larger respect to, you know, at low reaction, and the density of the gas went down is 1 plus z cubed. So if you calculate now in hydrostatic equilibrium, in an NFW, what is the density in the core? I mean, you can do this.
Huh?
The gas.
Okay.
It depends on the kilo concentration. Well, I mean, okay. In any case, if you believe that, assuming that, then you get an increase in the gas density in the core. So even a small galaxy can actually be able to accrete, in a sense, more gas. Right? And there is, of course, an effect to also the fact that the temperature of the AGM may be going down after mm-hmm. the integration. Now, with the new blazer thing, all of this may completely go away.
If you believe in that, but if you don't, then still. Yeah, sure. Now, this is for the old model. Do you want to see them for the new model? They're much better for the new model.
For the new model?
That's one thing that's definitely better.
your gas fraction really means compared to the massive stars?
Yes.
Sir, what's the gray?
The gray is the model, and the red is the same everywhere, and the stars are the CO measurements. I think the pentagons are also CO measurements, and the others are indirect. So, and the model also does very well at getting the H2 fraction, so the ratio of H1 to H2 at redshift zero, where we can measure it, predicts that very nicely. So, I mean, I think the new star formation model makes more sense physically. We should use it. There, you know, it's great. It just doesn't solve this problem, or these problems.
How do you go to fraction zero if you're in the NTDA's or mass galaxy?
You can have no gas.
From point A down to zero.
Yeah, I think there's satellites on here.
Sorry?
There's probably satellite galaxies on here. I think I forgot to take the satellites out. Or, I mean, you can also have galaxies that have no cold gas because, you know, they've just blown all the gas out or something.
So then you have a very stochastic behavior.
I mean, there is stochastic behavior in these models. It just may not be stochastic enough. And the main stochastic behavior... The main stochastic behavior is because if you have a starburst, then you can blow all the gas out pretty quickly. But the starbursts are only driven by mergers in this model, so they're not that common. But it can happen. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks a lot.